landfills, from a bird's perspective, is just a giant pile of food. For as long as humans have been throwing our trash, which includes edible things, into big piles, animals have been coming to eat it. And for birders, that means a lot of birds. And so a lot of gull watchers, sort of a sick, twisted subset of birders, go to landfills because that's where the gulls are. Landfills are one of the easiest places to see birds like bald eagles, frankly, ravens, and depending on where you are in the country or where the dump is, specialty raptors. So it's a time-honored tradition in the birding community.
Going to landfills is a time-honored tradition in the birding community. That was birder Nick Lund. He's with Audubon in the state of Maine, and he, and I guess a lot of others, have spent a lot of time scouting out the birds that hang out at landfills. Nikki, that is not your grandmother's style of bird watching.
Well, maybe it's not her style of bird watching, but here in Jasper, we used to have this dump in like the 70s or way back. And there was definitely opportunity for people like my grandparents to watch wildlife there, like bears or what have you. And even though the dump is gone, occasionally visitors or even locals still dump food on the sidewalks or near the campgrounds, and wildlife are on it. They cannot wait to get at it. There's nothing like a discarded hot dog bun. Am I right, Jay?
How would I know? I never discard the bun. Why would you do that? That's where the mustard and relish are hanging out. But you're right. In Canada, and this is an estimate, but it's about 2.2 metric tons of edible food is wasted each year. Landfills are, of course, the summit of that mountain of garbage, but garbage finds its way in lots of other places too. And while we've already heard that birds feed on landfills and are watched there, they're not the only wildlife affected by our casual attitude towards what we leave behind. Like coyotes, right? They're scavengers. They'll eat just about anything. In a few minutes, we're going to talk to Colleen Cassidy St. Clair. She's been studying urban coyotes for more than 20 years.
Yeah, and you won't believe what those coyotes are eating, or coyote. I say coyote, and now you say coyote. What is going on there? But anyways.
I'll say coyote if you want.
So that's what we're going to talk about today. You think that those fries that get left on the sidewalk are mostly harmless, but are they? That is the anthropomania we're going to get into.
And it's a first for us, and I love the concept, a mega dumpster dive.
That's right. So deep in the garbage. But back to landfills for a moment. So off the top, we heard Nick Lund talking about bird watching at landfills. In Canada, we have about 2,400 landfills across the country. Some are as big as 142 hectares, which is like 200 soccer pitches. That's just outside of London, Ontario. It's like looking out over a vast ocean of garbage. It's as far as the eye can see.
It's just about what you'd imagine. Mountains of putrid waste. Residential trash is about a third. The rest is commercial, industrial. And all of it is problematic for wildlife. And yet, it's a big draw for them. Rats, insects, other kinds of invertebrates. If you look up, you'll see raptors, maybe in some places vultures, tons of gulls, no matter where you are. But you know what? Nikki here knows something about seeing birds around human food waste. Just the other day, Nikki, you were so lucky. You got to visit the Jasper Transfer Station, the place where garbage and compost are taken to then be moved out of the national park.
Yeah, so I was at the Jasper Transfer Station the other day, and as you approach, crows and ravens are circling above, and you kind of pull up onto this ramp to check in, and I talked to the gate attendant, and she confirmed, actually, that people birdwatch there all the time, which was really fascinating. So I drove in to where the compost is, because as you said, we moved the trash out of the park, that's why it's called the transfer station, but we deal with some of our compost here. And as I drove up to where the compost was being worked, first of all, you're hit with this smell, and I was gagging, dry heaving. And then all these crows and ravens just take flight off the compost, you know, off the eggshells and the orange rinds. That is all I saw. There were no birds of note. But let me tell you, some of those ravens could steal a baby. They were so
Get
big.
Out of here. Really?
Yeah. They're massive. Oh, and the gate attendant told me that sometimes food gets dropped just outside the fence. And she's seen coyotes hanging out there, picking at the food. And the corvids, like the crows, etc., come down and are looking around the coyote. And she's seen a coyote grab one out of the air twice and eat it. It's a crazy ecosystem out there.
So it's interesting you use the word ecosystem because we don't think of it that way, right? We think of it as a place to shun, basically. And yet the wildlife that you just described is dependent on it. So, you know, landfill has become part of their life, one of the pieces of where they live. In fact, you know what? The experts on this kind of stuff have their own term for landfills. They call them PAFs. You know what that stands for?
Tell me.
Probably not. Predictable anthropogenic food subsidies. So they're looking at landfills as sources of food for wildlife. And even though, you know, there's a trend, I think, worldwide to modernize landfills, either phase out the old open style or close them up, or many are in the process of doing that, but they've still already made an impact. White storks live in Central Europe, used to migrate to Morocco in the winter. That's a long flight. But now they don't bother. Most of them stop in southern Spain and feed at landfills over the winter. They've saved themselves something like 1,000 kilometers in traveling.
That's a lot of calories.
Well, exactly. And uncertain food sources on the way. Landfills are certain. Egyptian vultures are kind of the same, right? Their populations aren't that huge, but they're strung all the way across Europe into the Middle East. They live pretty hazardous lives, and they have incorporated landfills on their sort of daily travels for trying to find food. And at least in Spain, some of the scientists studying this have pleaded with the government to slow down the closing off of landfills until they can figure out how to supply alternative food sources for these birds.
That's unbelievable to me that these birds have developed a search image for landfills because it's become so integral to their survival.
Yeah. Yeah. Ecosystem is the right word.
The thing is, it's not just landfills though, right? Wherever you find humans, you find garbage. And I see this here in a tourist town. We've got chocolate bar wrappers on the street and we've got pizza boxes lying near the garbage cans. We've got cookies and stuff crumbling out of people's beards and falling on the ground. So if there's people, there's food waste. And sometimes in the places you would least expect it, that you think are pristine, like the very famous Galapagos Islands.
Hi, my name is Luis De Leon, and I'm an assistant professor at the University of Massachusetts, Boston, at the Department of Biology. People think that Galapagos are very remote and there's no people, there's no humans there. In fact, there are nearly 25 to 30,000 people living on the archipelago. The human population is increasing really, really fast. And so there's these big towns where there's hotels, these bars, these restaurants. And so it's fairly touristic places, very bustling. And of course, you can imagine that as humans moved into these areas, they bring in introduced resources, from introduced plant species, human foods, even in some cases, invasive species that might alter the ecosystem.
You know, that's actually kind of shocking to me, and I'm embarrassed to admit this, but I toured the Galapagos a couple of years ago, and I guess the choice of places we went to made it clear that there weren't very many places where there were lots of humans, some, but I'm surprised at what De Leon is saying.
It's just like any other touristy area in some of these big towns. You know, people are eating bags of chips and they're walking around with burgers or sitting outdoors with their taco salad or what have you. There's discarded fries laying on the table. And it's having an effect on Darwin's finches, the ones that are famous for helping us understand evolution.
Ah, yes, the finches. You know, I saw a few when I was there. And actually, if I hadn't known they were Darwin's finches, I would have paid very little attention to them. Kind of unremarkable. A bit like we see sparrows in cities. Darwin, though, drew attention to the fact that there were radical differences in their beaks or bills, and he attributed that to what they ate. You need a big, thick bill to crush seeds and nuts. If you've got a slim bill, you feed on insects and spiders. And I think a lot of people now think or have heard that the finches were crucial to Darwin's theory of evolution, but there actually is some controversy about just how important. So one ancestral flock more than a million years ago has proliferated into, well, the numbers are not really clear. I've found sources saying anything from 13 to 18 different species. Regardless of the number, though, each one has a signature bill.
So in these big towns, De Leon was seeing different species of these finches eyeing up people's food, approaching tables, you know, like sparrows begging off people's trays. And he and his team wanted to know if the finches were developing a preference for human food over their natural food, which is seeds and nuts. So they built what they called the cafeteria experiment.
And so we set up these small trays where we put a combination of both natural food items, like seeds from different plant species, and also a different combination of human food types. And those included rice, for example, potato chips, you know, crackers, and different combinations. And so we set them randomly both in downtown Puerto Ayora. So we were kind of walking to, you know, different places, you know, between tourists sometimes, and kind of finding a spot where we set up those trays. And then you just wait there to see what happens. And we also replicated that in areas where there is no humans, and away from the towns, to compare the effects.
And what did you find?
So interestingly, when we do these experiments in downtown, finches essentially mobbed our trays. They will, you know, they will get extremely excited, and they will all jump into it. And interestingly, they will go almost 100% for human food types. In fact, they will mostly ignore their natural food types, and it goes just for human foods. In some cases, we even lost some of the trays because they will be so frantic, the trays will just flip over, and then the whole experiment will be ruined.
And in the rural areas, how did the birds behave?
When we replicated those experiments in the areas away from humans, finches will just ignore the tray overall. To us, that indicates that given that there is no humans or no human foods in those areas, they don't relate the, you know, human or human trays or human items with food.
It's kind of amazing to me. He goes out in the country. The birds in the country don't even touch the food. And I keep wondering, if you're a Darwin's finch who lives in the country, what goes through your mind? Hey, some of this I'm familiar with. I'll eat this. Some of this I've never seen before. I'm not touching that. You know, and yet, boy, the city birds have long since abandoned that prejudice.
So clearly this is a learned behavior for the town finches. In Jasper, we'd call them the townies. And the concern is that if enough of these finch species are affected, if they're all eating the same kinds of food, then the evolutionary drivers that forced them to become different species won't be there anymore. And there's a risk they could collapse back into one species if they start interbreeding again.
So that would be classic anthropomania, wouldn't it? Here's a whole bunch of finches that have evolved different bills because they're eating different food, but that's not enough for us. Let's introduce some hot dog buns or potato chips and see if we can create whole new species.
It'll have a beak that's just like for eating meat tubes. It'll be like a long hot dog-shaped beak.
We're not saying that's going to happen, but here's the thing, and this is a sort of serious question. So, you know, I'm wondering about this in a broader context. If you see this happening in the Galapagos, could it be happening everywhere that birds get access to human food? Could those birds be changing evolutionarily too? I asked Luis de Leon that exact question.
Exactly. That definitely is the case. And there are other examples, again, from insects as well to plants as well. We are an urban species as humans, and we are creating these amazing novel ecosystems. And so we can imagine that we are essentially ensemble this whole new community of species. This offers an opportunity also to understand how evolution happens in nature. And the reason for that is that evolution generally will take too long as people think about it. But these changes in urban environments or in human-driven changes, they happen really, really fast. And if so, they offer an opportunity to see how evolution happens before our eyes, essentially.
Does this depress you a little that we're, you know, our heavy human hand is changing evolution in a number of species?
People think about evolution as this kind of natural process that happens in the wild. But we can consider humans also as a strong evolutionary force. And the way that we interact with the environment, with the species, we're actually imposing selection or changing the strengths or direction of selection in natural environments. And this has implications for example, conservation. When we look at or think about preserving biodiversity or preserving species, we often focus on preserving the species per se. However, by looking at these processes in urban or in altered environments in general, we can imagine that in order to preserve biodiversity, we also need to preserve the processes that ultimately lead to that biodiversity. This is very complex issues. And I mean, it is an exciting time to actually try to understand that. And sometimes, of course, it's depressing in the sense that we're altering natural environments in unprecedented ways. In our cases, it reflects or it provides an opportunity to understand better how this process works in a natural environment.
I think I'm with DeLeon. I mean, it's super depressing that it's happening, but at the same time, it's really fascinating. And I'm hoping what we learn from these kinds of experiments and this research helps us do conservation better, not just for birds, because this goes far beyond birds.
No kidding. Birds, two legs. There are lots of four-legged animals. There are some six-legged and, that are eating waste. There are some eight-legged. There are
so
multi-legged.
Many legs.
There's no limit to the number of legs. But of all the familiar four-legged animals likely to be close to a dump or a trash heap, it would have to be the coyote. So do you remember, Nikki, in our first season, Chris Schell told us a story about a coyote in Chicago who walked into a Quiznos, attracted by the smell of the sandwiches, and then lay down in front of the fridge with the drinks. And I think he said people didn't really care. They just kept eating their sandwiches. So that coyote can tick off the box. Yeah, I'm comfortable with humans.
Yeah, it's definitely habituated. I like that people were just kind of floating in to buy a kombucha and it was just like, meh, just laying there.
Yeah, exactly.
But the research on urban coyotes is fascinating. One of the most interesting recent discoveries involving coyotes, or coyotes, if you like, was made by the coyote queen of Canada, Colleen Cassidy St. Clair, in Edmonton.
My name is Colleen Cassidy St. Clair. I'm a professor of biological sciences at the University of Alberta, where I've been for about 24 years. I study the interface between wildlife conservation and management, and animal behavior.
You may have heard of the Stanley Park problem in Vancouver, where coyotes were attacking people. Actually, it was recently reported there were 45 cases there that resulted in culling. Coyotes are increasing in cities because they are generalists. They can easily adapt to human behavior, like they'll eat your cat, they'll eat the cat food you leave on the porch, they'll raid your garbage. They'll even eat your dog's poop. I mean, are there limits to what they will ingest?
Well, we also have received several photos from people of coyotes climbing trees to eat, for example, crab apples, or standing on their hind legs to eat fruit from cherry trees. We know that coyotes eat a lot of birdseed, an astonishing amount of birdseed, especially in late winter, but also dogs and cats that are unattended, especially cats and feral cats. The feeding of feral cats is creating an attractant for urban coyotes, for sure.
And that's just what we can see them eating. but coyotes will eat practically anything, and Colleen knows this because she will open up their stomachs in the interest of science and in the interest of understanding what their diet is. And she's seen a lot of weird shit.
I do have a few favorites. Well, one of them was a stomach that contained an amazing array of things. It had part of a leather glove, a Tim Hortons muffin wrapper, part of an apple core, but also some pincherry seeds, what looked like the stem of grapes, also a pocket gopher claw, and what looked like a deer mouse foot. All of those things were in the last meal of that particular coyote. One, I remember, had an entire family of pocket gophers, mom, and eight little babies, and they almost were in the stomach in a row. Another stomach had a big chunk of meat in it, and I pulled that out, and I was looking at it and turning it over in my hands and thinking, wow, this is amazing. It's like it's square. And I noticed that the square piece of muscle was perfectly seared on the outside and beautifully medium rare on the inside. It was a cow muscle in the form of a steak. So somehow a coyote got an entire, sort of 6-ounce-sized chunk of steak.
Sounds like the coyotes are eating better than some of your students.
They might.
Steak dinner.
Gobbling down a steak, apparently without really chewing it, is one thing. But Nikki, swallowing a glove or a gopher?
Gloves.
I mean, it sounds like it would be just a horrible hit on your digestion.
You'd think this would impact the microbiome, which is really just the collection of microbes in the body. And one of Colleen's students, Scott Sudgeon, wanted to compare the gut biome of urban and rural coyotes. And what he discovered was this very distinct difference between the city coyote and the country coyote.
He found that the community diversity of the microbiome of the urban coyotes was broader. Presumably, they ate a broader diversity of things that fed a broader diversity of microbes in their stomachs and intestines. Scott also found that the microbiome of those urban-dwelling coyotes was richer in particular kinds of bacteria that are associated with mostly lactic acid bacteria that are associated with digesting carbohydrates, that include things like birdseed and garbage. Sometimes we find in their stomachs or in their scat actually pieces of plastic or paper. But we also measure their longer-term diets using stable isotopes. An isotope of carbon shows us how much they've been eating corn. And of course, corn doesn't grow naturally here in Edmonton, except for very persistent gardeners like my dad. Where coyotes are getting corn is from processed food. It's a super common ingredient, as people know, in any kind of processed food, even meats.
So in other words, they're eating human food, lots of it. And that's not the surprising bit. He started to put some pieces together with some earlier findings, and it made Scott wonder, could all this carb loading actually be changing the coyote's behavior?
So he found the rural coyotes that had more protein consumption had healthier body condition generally, and they had microbiomes that were richer in the bacteria that are associated with protein digestion, suggesting that was their longer-term diet. And the interesting thing about those bacteria, Fusobacteria in particular, is that the absence of that one has been correlated in domestic dogs with aggressive behavior. So the absence of those bacteria in the more urban animals is also suggestive of changes in their behavior. And that's something that we are speculating about at this point. We don't have a cause and effect relationship. But we do have a really curious anecdote from Scott's study. And that is that we had one extremely aggressive coyote in our sample of carcasses, an animal that was lethally removed because it had killed a Bernese mountain dog that weighed over 100 pounds. So this dog outweighed the coyote by at least 3 times. And it seems from the site where the dog died that the coyote killed it by pinning it to the ground, biting it in the neck, and holding it there until it bled to death. There is no evidence of a scuffle, just a very aggressive attack by a single animal. So assuming we got the right animal as a carcass when it was removed for the safety of people, because this happened just behind a backyard of a residence, that animal had no fusobacteria in its intestine. None at all. The absence, remember, of Fusobacteria is the thing that's associated with aggression in dogs. So that's pretty curious.
That is curious and actually interesting, but still speculative, right? After all, it's one case. I suspect that they would like to do a lot more.
And I think they are going to do a lot more, not just on coyotes, gulls, crows, but this study of wildlife microbiomes is really going to grow because, as you know, Jay, you are what you eat. And that applies to all creatures.
And all creatures feeding on our waste is kind of disturbing and depressing. But there's another much smaller species you might not have even considered being affected when, you know, a kid drops an ice cream cone on the sidewalk, and that's ants.
I'm Amy Savage, and I'm an assistant professor in the Department of Biology and the Center for Integrative and Computational Biology at Rutgers University, Camden. What is endlessly fascinating to me is all the different ways that ants can affect ecosystems. And they're really common in cities. And it's really interesting to me to think about the ecology underfoot. So, you know, if we can walk through a city the way we walk through a forest and really think about the organisms that share our spaces, I think that we could have a better appreciation of how we're part of this diverse landscape, not just a single organism. This is a group of organisms that we are really closely linked to. We know from a very young age, if we drop our ice cream on the ground, ants are probably going to come and get it. And yet, no one really understands what that means for the ants, what that means for the other organisms that live with them. And that's kind of the starting point I had.
Amy studied what's called the pavement ant, very common in cities, and they're very warlike. And if you're walking along a sidewalk one day, you might just look down and see this incredible pavement ant war being fought out over territory. But when they're not fighting, they're eating, and their normal diet is like other bugs, plant bits, nectar, seeds, and stuff like that.
Ants are very opportunistic. They're generalists, very adaptable, which is why the minute you take out your picnic food at the beach or at the park, you are swarmed by ants. But what does eating all this human food really mean for them? She set up what she called the Broadway experiment to see what pavement ants would eat.
It was really simple. We put out potato chips, cookies, and hot dogs on Broadway in New York City. And we basically had them put in either caged or uncaged conditions. So in the cages, it was really just ants getting to them. And outside the cages, anything, a rat, a bird, a squirrel, name it, could come and eat that food. And we came back just like 48 hours later. And what we found was that in parks, it was pretty clear that vertebrates were eating at least half of the food that we left out. When we went to the street medians, this is where rats are king. It was all ants. Ants were doing all of the food waste removal. And when we looked at which ants were doing it, it was all this pavement ant. If that pavement ant was present, then ants were getting all the food before rats could get to it. If it wasn't, then the rats had a fighting chance. So that one is a big one when we talk about ants that consume food waste in cities.
So do you think it's fair to say that human food or human food waste is changing the evolutionary course of ants, or at least changing them in some fundamental way?
I don't know about evolution. That's something that takes more evidence than what we have now. But certainly it's acting as a filter, because not all ants will scavenge on human food waste. And so those that will are going to do much better than other species.
So Amy Savage, along with our other guests, say we can't quite say that human food is affecting the evolution of their species, but it's definitely affecting the behavior.
And it's part of a sequence, right? Darwin's finches, good example. Different kinds of food available. Those birds that randomly by mutation have slightly larger bills. They'll change their behavior to concentrate on the food that best suits that bill. And that's how it goes. So I think even if all we've seen so far is behavior, that's really important.
What's interesting to me is my reaction to the changing of Darwin's finches, you know, as someone who kind of grew up with this theory of evolution and learning about his work, was really mortified. And yet when I think about coyotes or gulls or whatever in the landfill, it affected me a little less. And I kind of had to think about that in myself. Like, why do I see some wildlife as being sort of more natural or part of nature and others being sort of the trash animals or the ones that are somehow less wild because they've come to live with us in our towns and cities?
I think that's exactly it. I think somewhere in us, we all like to think that nature is out there and that we're not really in it, like the forest, the desert, the oceans. When we think of them, I don't think we think of them as being heavily populated by humans. And when we do come across situations where animals and humans are coexisting, like, you know, finches picking up here, the classic example you used, your hot dog bun that just fell off the table. I think it's just familiarity breeds contempt. They're no longer that separate part of nature, and so they're not as natural.
And what that means is we don't often see ourselves as part of the natural world, which kind of explains our outlook on some things, I think.
On most things, I think. And you know, remember Nick Lund, the landfill bird watcher we heard at the beginning of this episode? This separation of people from nature is exactly what he thinks.
I can understand someone who, you know, wants to think of something more pristine as the natural world, as separate from what we do, but it's just simply not the reality. And I think ignoring the reality of the spread of our impact really makes it more challenging for us to recognize our impact and fix our impact. You know, when you plant native plants in your backyard, even if you're not in the middle of a national park, you're going to support native birds and native insects. When you take actions to protect local trees near you, even if it's not in the middle of a big forest, I mean, that has an impact. And when we think about our environmental impact, we think about ways to solve things or improve things. We can really think on the local level, even if it's not what we think of the classic wilderness experience, and impact nature. And sort of embracing the fact that the natural world is all around us as soon as we open the door helps us understand how we can improve it and how we can lessen our impacts.
I love that. And you know, maybe we can lessen our impact by starting to throw a little love to an ant next time you see it on your doorstep. And speaking of ants, I am super excited about our next episode. It is all about insects. I love bugs. I'm a bugster. Even in my house, I love them. But not all insects are as well taken care of as my house spiders. Insect species are actually disappearing around the world at a pretty alarming rate. And scientists are very concerned about this. We're experiencing what some people have called the insect apocalypse. And part of the problem is insects freak people out. So as usual, on the next episode, we will talk to the experts, insect conservationist Scott Black, author Jeffrey Lockwood, and recovering arachnophobe Catherine Scott will spread the spider love around.
So if you haven't already, make sure to hit follow on this app. And thanks a lot to today's awesome guests, Nick Lund, Colleen Cassidy St. Clair, Luis De Leon, and Amy Savage. We have links to their work in our show notes. And if you like this episode, let us know by leaving a review. You can also give us your feedback on our listener survey or DM us on social at Anthropomania. We're on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. Don't forget to sign up for our newsletter, which has a ton of extra episode content and really fun behind the scenes of our show. You can sign up on the website at anthropomania.com. See you next time.
Bye.